Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Jeremiah chapter 48, which I will call Judgment on Moab. I'm not going to be able to do the whole chapter. It's 47 verses long. I'll go through the first 25 verses. But this audio and the next audio will focus on a simple thing, Moab's destruction by Babylon, which occurred in 582 BC. Now, there are a lot of place names, all of which are in Moab, so I've got a lot of maps in front of me. I'll try to slog my way through these geographical references without bogging us down too much. So we start in verses 1 through 3, Jeremiah 48. Concerning Moab, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Woe to Nebo, for it will be ruined. Kiriathaim will be disgraced and captured. The stronghold will be disgraced and shattered. Moab will be praised no more. In Heshbon, men will plot her downfall. Come, let us put an end to that nation. You too, O madmen. That's a place. Sounds like a TV series about advertisers on Madison Avenue, but that's not what it is. It's a place. You too, O madmen, will be silenced. The sword will pursue you. Listen to the cries from Horonaim, cries of great havoc and destruction. Now, Moab was conquered by the Babylonians in 582, as I said. This is from Encyclopedia Britannica. Josephus records this destruction of Moab. He has it in 582, 581, or 582, 5 years after the fall of Babylon. Of course, the fall of Babylon is sometimes dated 587, so close enough, within 1 year. Now, God says, Yahweh says in verse 1, woe to Nebo. John Gill says of Nebo that this was thought to be an oracular city, a city of oracles, where was a temple of their idol, and from whence their priest gave out oracles, promising peace and prosperity and safety. And according to Gill, this is why Jeremiah mentions Nebo first, to show that Nebo was worthless, useless to rely on that city because of its lying oracles. Nebo, of course, is famous in Old Testament history 1,000 years earlier. Moses stood at the peak of Mount Nebo and got his look at the Promised Land. He never entered it. He died a little bit north of Mount Nebo at Mount Pisgah. This is what Wikipedia says about the city of Nebo. It's 3.5 kilometers from Mount Nebo, where Moses got his view of the Promised Land. We read about this in Deuteronomy 34, verse 1. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which faces Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan. Nebo and Pisgah were two peaks of the same mountain ridge. That's why they sort of sound like they're run together in Deuteronomy 34. Now, Kiriathaim will be disgraced and captured. Looking at my map, Kiriathaim is about 5 miles south-southwest of Nebo. Now, before I go any further, I'm going to divide Moab into regions so I can identify where these places are. I'm going to use the Dead Sea as an anchor because everybody knows where the Dead Sea is. Now, the Arnon River runs east to west and dumps into the Dead Sea about halfway down the coast. So above the Arnon River will be the northern part of Moab. Below the Arnon River will be the southern part of Moab. Now, there's a road that runs from Egypt up to Damascus called the King's Highway. It runs in the flatlands right to the east of the Hilu region of Moab. And so to the east of that road, I'll call that East Moab. I'm making these names up. People don't call it East Moab, but that's what I'm going to call it, just so we can get oriented. So let me repeat that. North of the Arnon River will be the north of Moab, and that's to the east of the northernmost part of the Dead Sea. The Arnon River, I'll just call Middle Moab. And then once we get south of the Arnon River, I'll call it Southern Moab. Now, Kiriathaim is right, as I said, southwest of Mount Nebo, or the city of Nebo, which is in northern Moab. Kiriathaim is also said to be disgraced and captured. Looking at the map, we see that Kiriathaim is about 5 miles or so south-southwest of Nebo, still up there in the northern part of Moab. Now in verse 2, Moab will be praised no more in Heshbon. Men will plot her downfall. That's a very well-known city. It's on the King's Highway that runs from Egypt up to Syria, and it's at the very northern tip of the Dead Sea to the eastern part. So that's in northern Moab. In Heshbon, men will plot her downfall. That, of course, would be Babylonians who've already captured Heshbon will plot the downfall of the rest of Moab. The NIV translation's note says that the Hebrew for Heshbon sounds like the Hebrew for plot. So there's a little pun there for all of you who know Hebrew, which I don't. So there will be plotting in Heshbon to plot the downfall of Moab. Come, let us put an end to that nation. I assume that's Babylonians doing the plotting as they come down. The Babylonians will be coming down from the north, of course, because that's how they came into the Promised Land, from the northern region as they crossed the Euphrates River up in Syria. You two old madmen will be silenced. Now, madmen is in the southern part of Moab, right across the mountains that are on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, almost at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. That's madmen. So you too, O madmen, will be silenced. The sword will pursue you. Listen to the cries from Horonaim, cries of great havoc and destruction. Horonaim, looking at the map, is about 5 miles south and southwest of madmen in the southern region of Moab. So in verses 1 through 3, we go from the north to the south, Heshbon in the far north to Horonaim in the far south. Moab will be completely wiped out by the Babylonians. We go down to verses 4 through 9 of Jeremiah 48. Moab will be broken. Her little ones will cry out. They go up the way to Luhith, weeping bitterly as they go. On the road down to Horonaim, anguished cries over the destruction are heard. Flee, run for your lives. Become like a bush in the desert. Since you trust in your deeds and riches, you too will be taken captive, and Chemosh will go into exile, together with his priests and officials. The destroyer will come against every town, and not a town will escape. The valley will be ruined and the plateau destroyed, because the Lord has spoken. Put salt on Moab, for she will be laid waste. Her towns will become desolate, with no one to live in them. In verse 4, Moab will be broken. Her little ones will cry out, as John Gill says, seeing their parents killed, and they left desolate and in the hands of the enemy, and not only so, but just going to be dashed in pieces by them. In other words, the little ones will cry out because they're captured, and then they'll cry out because they're about to get their head smashed against a rock. Bad business for Moab. Verse 5, they, the children, go up the way to Luhith. Now, if you look at the map, Luhith is even further south than Horonaim, about 10 miles south-southwest. It's really close to the southern tip of the Dead Sea, to the east of the Dead Sea, and it's in the mountains there on the edge of the Dead Sea. So the children are weeping bitterly as they go. On the road down to Horonaim, anguished cries over the destruction are heard. So there's a road from Luhith to Horonaim. They're about 10 miles apart. Verse 6, flee, run for your lives. Now, who is speaking here? It could be Jeremiah just telling the Moabites, you better run. Could be poetically referring to the Moabites who are saying to themselves, flee, run for your lives. Become like a bush in the desert. I think it's Jeremiah saying it. He's saying, hey, Moabites, become like a bush, as John Gill says, low, naked, barren, fruitless shrub, signifying that when they were fled from their habitations, they should be as solitary and stripped of all their good things as such a barren, naked shrub in a desert. Verse 7, since, that means because you trust in your deeds and your riches, because you trust in all your idolatrous worship and all the money you've got that you can hire mercenary soldiers with. Because you trust in that and not in Yahweh, you too will be taken captive. And Chemosh will go into exile. Chemosh was the famous god of the Moabites, and not only the Moabites, but the Ammonites. Ammon was the country right to the north of Moab. It ran from the northern tip of the Dead Sea right around Heshbon all the way up to the Jabbok River, which is about a third of the way up the valley of Gilead there, going up the valley that connects the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee. That's Ammon. Moab is to the south of Ammon. But Chemosh was a god for both of those people. In fact, the Moabites are called the people of Chemosh in Numbers 21, verse 29. Woe to you, Moab! You have been destroyed, people of Chemosh. In verse 8, Jeremiah continues to prophesy, the destroyer will come against every town, and not a town will escape. That destroyer, of course, is Nebuchadnezzar II, the king of Babylon, who, after destroying Judah in 586, came down to Moab and destroyed Moab in 582. The valley will be ruined and the plateau destroyed. The valley is the low places in Moab. The plateau is the high places in Moab. In other words, from the depths to the heights, everywhere, it's going to be gone. It's going to be destroyed. Why? Because the Lord has spoken. Verse 9, put salt on Moab, for she will be laid waste. Well, now, here is an interesting Hebrew word. I am going to give you 7 different translations that I have found on how that word might be translated. Salt is one. Number 2, a sign. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible note. Moab is a sign. A flower, that's the Vulgate translation, according to the Holman Christian Study Bible note. Put a flower on Moab? Really? The Syriac translation and the Targums are Aramaic translations of the Hebrew text for the Aramaic speakers of Palestine, right around the time of Jesus. The Targum and the Syriac translation have put a crown on Moab. A crown? What does that mean? Holman Christian Study Bible says, make Moab a salt marsh. Now that makes sense. Bible in basic English says, make Moab a pillar. Why would Moab be made a pillar? This is supposed to be something bad happening to Moab. That doesn't make sense. Now, a lot of the older translations have give wings to Moab. This is the ASV, the Darby translation, the KJV, the NASB, and the Young's Literal Translation say that. Why would Jeremiah want Moab to have wings? Well, I guess so that she can fly, so that she can flee, so that she can get out of town, get out of Dodge before the Babylonians get to her. Well, that's reasonable. The New American Bible has make Moab a memorial. In other words, a byword for destruction so that everybody in history can remember Moab as being a nation destroyed by the Babylonians. And that makes sense. So salt, salt marsh, memorial, all makes sense. Give wings to Moab, that makes sense too. But it's apparent that nobody knows how to translate whatever that Hebrew word is. So, hey, if nobody knows, why not just say, put a horse halter around Moab? I mean, who knows? But the point is that Moab is toast, desolate. No one's going to live there anymore. We go now to verses 10 through 13 of Jeremiah 48. And before I read you these four verses, I need to say that it's not clear sometimes who's speaking, Jeremiah or Jeremiah speaking for the Lord. The quotation marks are not in the original text, and the translations put the quotation marks in different places, so I quit trying to decide. I'll just say Jeremiah speaking right here. A curse on him who is lax in doing the Lord's work. I'm at Jeremiah 48, starting at verse 10. A curse on him who is lax in doing the Lord's work. A curse on him who keeps his sword from bloodshed. Moab has been at rest from youth, like wine left on its dregs, not poured from one jar to another. She has not gone into exile. So she tastes as she did, and her aroma is unchanged. But days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will send men who pour from jars, and they will pour her out. They will empty her jars and smash her jugs. Then Moab will be ashamed of Chemosh, as the house of Israel was ashamed when they trusted in Bethel. Verse 10, Jeremiah cast an oath of imprecation, or words of imprecation, on him who is lax in doing God's works. Who is the him? Well, that's the Babylonians. The Babylonians are doing the Lord's work. They are not consciously working for Yahweh, but they are doing the Lord's work anyway because Yahweh is the sovereign Lord of the universe, and he controls everything, even without violating our free will. And so Jeremiah says, may Babylon be cursed if they're slow in what they're doing. A curse on him who keeps his sword from bloodshed. They'll be cursed if they don't start whacking the Moabites. And then in verse 11, Jeremiah says, Moab has been at rest from youth, like wine left on its dregs. The dregs are the solid parts of fermenting wine that drips down to the bottom of the wine bottle, the wine skin. The longer you leave it there, the stronger the wine gets, until pretty soon it tastes like vinegar. Now, I'm not an expert on wine. I've never made wine. I've never seen wine in its unprocessed state, but I think that's an accurate statement. The longer you leave the wine sitting on its dregs, don't move it around, the more full-bodied, the more strong, the stronger it becomes. And so that wine is not poured from one jar to another. You pour it, you stir it up, and it becomes weaker. So that's the way Moab has been. She's just been sitting. Nobody's ever bothered her. Nobody's ever put her into exile. So she tastes just like she's always tasted. And how does she taste? And she smells just like she's always smelled. Her aroma is unchanged. Well, how did she smell? Well, Moab was noted for its pride and arrogance, and she has constantly been proud and arrogant for as long as she has existed. She's been wealthy, she's been prosperous, she's had riches, she's been full of sin and vices, she's been idolatrous, she's been proud, she's been luxurious ever since she became a nation. Verse 12, but days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will send men who pour from jars. Again, continuing with the analogy with wine, Moab is sitting on its dregs, not changing, but the Babylonians are going to come, take Moab and pour her out. They're going to make her jars empty. Not just pour from one jar to another to make her a sweet-tasting or fine-tasting wine, but the Babylonians are going to pour her out on the ground. They will empty her jars, smash her jugs, and once the Moabites get poured out on the ground, then the empty wineskins will be tromped on, smashed. Then Moab will be ashamed of Chemosh because Chemosh did not protect Moab. That's what idolatrous gods were supposed to do in pagan nations. They're supposed to protect the people. It's really funny. All these pagan nations had all these pagan gods in their temples. Protect us, protect us. But they were constantly beating up on each other, destroying one another, taking one another into exiles, burning down their fortified cities. So these gods are not really doing the job, are they? Jeremiah is not content to make fun of Chemosh. He also makes fun of an idol that the northern Israelites had adopted. Moab is going to be just as ashamed as the house of Israel was ashamed when they trusted in Bethel, and Bethel is a short way of saying the golden calf that was set up under Jeroboam the First at Bethel. They were worshiping Yahweh, but they were using an improper form, a golden calf. Jeroboam ruled in 931 to 910. That was when Solomon had died, the last sole king of Israel, and the kingdom got split into two halves, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom had a king, Jeroboam, who set up golden calf idolatrous worship from Dan to Bethel. Dan was at the north of the kingdom. They had a golden calf up there. Then Bethel was at the very southern end of the northern half of Israel. And they put a calf there. And that's what Jeremiah is referring to here. I can read you a scripture that summarizes that. 1 Kings 12:28-29. So the king sought advice. That's Jeroboam the First. Then he made two golden calves, and he said to the people, "Going to Jerusalem is too difficult for you. Israel, here is your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." He set up one in Bethel and put the other in Dan. A golden calf, the same golden calf, of course, that was set up when Moses took too long coming down from Mount Sinai. He comes down there, and all the people are drinking, feasting, and making a golden calf. These ancient people loved their idols. Well, Moab's going to be taught about idolatry. We're going out of Jeremiah 48, verses 14 through 20. This is Yahweh speaking here. I think it's Yahweh, it could be Jeremiah. "How can you say we are warriors, men valiant in battle? Moab will be destroyed and her towns invaded. Her finest young men will go down in the slaughter," declares the king, whose name is the Lord Almighty. That's capital K, King Yahweh. Jeremiah is either quoting Yahweh or he's putting Yahweh's words in his mouth. Now, this prophecy in verse 15, Moab will be destroyed. Well, that was true. As the Encyclopedia Britannica says, as I mentioned earlier, Moab was conquered by the Babylonians in 582, after which they disappear from history. I don't know how the Encyclopedia Britannica knows that. They're probably quoting Josephus. But at any rate, it's very clear what chapter 48 is referring to. Specific country, specific time, specific invader makes it easy. Verse 16, "The fall of Moab is at hand. Her calamity will come quickly. Mourn for her. All who live around her, all who know her fame, say, how broken is the mighty scepter, how broken the glorious staff." And of course, a scepter and a staff were symbols of authority of a king, traditional. The iron rod they stuck between their feet as they sat on their throne, and they grabbed the top part of the rod. "Come down from your glory and sit on the parched ground." I assume that the scepter and the staff are two different words for the same rod. Verse 18, "Come down from your glory and sit on the parched ground, O inhabitants of the daughter of Dibon, for he who destroys Moab will come up against you and ruin your fortified cities." Come down from your glory and sit on the parched ground. That sounds like come down from the mountains where you are, Dibon. Well, where's Dibon? If you look at the map, the Arnon River flows right into the Dead Sea about one-third of the way. Let's just say halfway up the eastern coast of the Dead Sea. Dibon is on the King's Highway from Egypt to Damascus, just north of the source of the Arnon River. I'd say about 5 miles or so. It looks like it's at the bottom of a low ridge of hills on the map. So maybe Jeremiah is talking about physically come down from your glory and sit on the parched ground, the desert ground. But even if he is not speaking physically, he's speaking metaphorically. You're not so glorious anymore. You're going to be sitting on the ground like a beggar. Daughter of Dibon, of course, daughter is the standard metaphor for the population of a city. "For he who destroys Moab," that would be Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon, "will come up against you and ruin your fortified cities. Stand by the road and watch, you who live in Aroer." Aroer is about maybe 4 miles or so to the southeast of Dibon, again on the King's Highway, right as you get to the foot of the hills from whence the headwaters of the Arnon River start flowing on down to the Dead Sea. So the daughter of Dibon is going to watch the destroyer ruin the fortified cities, and then those who live in Ara, about 4 miles to the southwest, they're going to stand by the road, and they're going to ask the man fleeing and the woman escaping, ask them what has happened. Moab is disgraced, for she is shattered. Wail and cry out, announced by the Arnon, that's the Arnon River, that Moab is destroyed. Remember, Ara is right by that river. We go now to Jeremiah 48, verses 21 through 25, and we will finish this first half of the chapter. And we will finish this audio. Judgment has come to the plateau, to Holon, Jaza, and Mephath, to Dibon, Nebo, and Beth Diblathim, to Kiriathim, Beth Gamel, and Beth Meon, to Kiriath and Basra, to all the towns of Moab, far and near. Moab's horn is cut off, her arm is broken, declares the Lord. Now, I'm not going to bore you by trying to go through all these towns, but I'm going to mention some of the most famous ones or prominent ones. Of course, I've already mentioned Dibon right there, about 4 or 5 miles north of the Arnon River, near the king, on the King's Highway. Nebo, of course, is to the northern part of Moab, the mountain that Moses stood on so he could get a view of the promised land that he was never going to enter. That mountain is still there. I got a picture of it off of Wikipedia. It looks bare. There's not a tree on it. I don't know what it was like back in Moses' time, but it's very bare, and all around it is pretty flat. But that's Nebo, Beth Diblathim is actually up in the northern part, but the eastern northern part of Moab to the east of the King's Highway. Mephath is mentioned. That is, again, far to the east of the King's Highway. Going toward the south is just north of where the Arnon River would be if it were extended into the desert, but it's basically in the desert. Now, it's interesting. Kiriath is mentioned. That is down halfway between Mephath and Beth Diblathim. Kiriath, to the east of the King's Highway, to the east of Dibon, was the home of someone you might be familiar with, Judas Iscariot. That's where the term Iscariot comes from, of Kiriath, translated into the Greek or transliterated into the Greek, comes out as Iscariot. So that's sort of interesting. It won't increase your spirituality to know that, but it is interesting. Another town is mentioned is Basra. Now, there's a famous Basra in Edom, which is to the south of the Dead Sea. We're to the north of that area now in Moab. One of my commentators says this is a different place. This is the same as Bezer. If you look at the map, Bezer is right at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, far to the east of the King's Highway, about 7 or 8 miles to the east of Heshbon. And then Jeremiah just summarizes in verse 24, judgment has come to all the towns of Moab. He just mentioned a few of them for examples. I like to go through all this because it shows how historical this is. This is not somebody making up a myth. This is history here. Jeremiah was a prophet, but he was also an historian. Of course, this is prophecy now. This is not history yet. I'm assuming that Jeremiah prophesied this before 582. Verse 25, Moab's horn is cut off. Of course, an animal's strength is located in its horn. If you want to get hit by a bull, probably would rather get hit by his chest. Not by his horn. Of course, it wouldn't be fun to have that happen either. Or to be kicked by his leg, even. That's bad. But getting hit by a bull's horn is fatal, probably. So a horn is a symbol of strength, and Moab's horn's been cut off. No more strength. Her arm is broken. Of course, an arm is what you hold a sword with. Broken arm, you don't have a sword. You don't fight. You're toast. And on that happy note, we are now finished with the first half of Jeremiah 48. That will prepare us to go to our next audio, in which we will discuss the last half of Jeremiah 48, in which I will call Judgment on Moab Part B. This audio was Judgment on Moab Part A. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay with me for our next discussion and our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.